This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiaoyik. It's our public health show today, and that means my co-host for this segment, Azrul Muhammad Khalib, the CEO of Galen Center for Health and Social Policy, is joining me on Zoom. Hi, Azrul. How are you today?
Hi, Shariam. Very well, thank you.
Right. So today we want to talk about what's on everyone's minds, of course, COVID and the MCO, the full MCO 3.0 that we are. We entered just a little over a week ago, and that was, of course, in a bid to curb record numbers of COVID-19 cases, deaths, as well as ICU admissions. Now, what we want to find out is, so we are in a full MCO right now. What does that mean? How do we transition out of this MCO? What should we be looking to put in place right now, a sort of exit strategy to ensure that this lockdown isn't just a temporary breather, but a chance to properly bring our cases into a downward trend. So we have joining us on the show today, Azrul, we have Datuk Dr. Christopher Lee, infectious diseases physician. How are you, Dr. Chris? You're muted, Dr. Chris.
Okay, I'm always muted. I'm at home, so it's always muted. Yeah.
Knew that was coming.
Okay. Apologize. I forgot.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Chris. I know you're very, very busy, but I think there are some important messages that we hope to get from you as a reminder to everyone, what we should be on guard for, what we need to look out for. As you know, we are constantly tracking these daily numbers. What does it mean to us? And, what should we keep in perspective? So for all of you listening, our phone lines are open, 03-77-332-900, or you can WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. So Dr. Chris, like we said, right, we are now a week plus or so into this full MCO. The number of cases do seem to have gone down from that peak of about 9,000 plus that we saw just before the lockdown. Does that mean this MCO 3.0 is succeeding? Is it good news?
I mean, obviously the numbers coming down is good news, but without trying to burst anyone's bubble, the MCO will work. I mean, the lockdown will work. We put everybody at home, minimize movement or decrease movement, the number of infections will drop. And I think that's not surprising. The numbers will fall. The tighter the lockdown is, the faster and the more drastic the drop of new cases will be. The MCO 2.0, I think you remember the earlier MCO when many of the economic sectors were still open. The drop in cases was not very much because there's still a lot of people moving around. So I think it must be clear, the lockdown 3.0, or this version of lockdown, which is probably between the first and second lockdown, it's somewhere between there, isn't it, will work. The numbers will come down. So I think people should not get excited about it. This is to be expected. It will come down. Mm-hmm. The question is how much and how fast. My biggest concern is how do we transition out of it? I mean, sure, we locked down Malaysia for 2 years. The cases will be minimized. Obviously, we're not talking about locking ourselves down so long. The important question is how do we release the valve without having a big upsurge and to make sure we don't go into this predicament again. Because if not, we'll be literally living from one lockdown to another lockdown. And that is obviously not good for all of us in every sector. That would not be good. So I think that focus should be on that. How do we get ourselves out of this lockdown in a safer way?
But, Dr. Chris, one of the things that people have been quite concerned about is looking at the data and statistics, and most importantly, the analysis, what the data is telling us concerning Malaysia's epidemic, and we've been hearing from the very beginning discussions about R0, the number of cases, new infections, number of daily infections, number of deaths. And now we're hearing about positivity rates. And it's something that people are trying to gauge for themselves. The questions that you just raised, at what point can we say that we're exiting what we're experiencing right now? I mean, what do we look at? Because the testing numbers, which you just mentioned just now, seem to be even influenced by things like weekends, public holidays, you know. It's almost bizarre to think that, you know, what we're seeing right now could be as a result of people being on a long public holiday. So what are the figures that we should be looking at? What are the data points that people out there should be looking at to help them understand where Malaysia is in terms of this epidemic?
Certainly, I think, Azrul, you brought up a very good point in the sense that when we quote numbers, the number of new infections, the new cases that we pick up every day, of course, is heavily linked to the number of tests we do per day on that particular day, obviously. The other important fact is, have the testing strategy changed? Are we testing the same type or cohort of people? If we change, suddenly we start testing a different cohort of people in different areas, the outcome, of course, will be different. I think that we can take that from the HIV story, isn't it? Depends who you test, the prevalence will be different. But clearly, if there's no change in the testing strategy, and the testing numbers are done in the fixed criteria from day to day, then I think we can actually look at the positivity of it, which is the number of positive cases, confirmed infections, divided by the total number of tests we have done on that day. That's the positivity rate. Now, obviously, if the positivity rate drops, that means you could say that the number of infections in Malaysia today, on this particular day, is less than, let's say, a number that was higher last week. So this is a fair number to track. But I think clearly something even more important is we are making the assumption that in the whole peninsula and Sabah, Sarawak, the pandemic is homogenous. It is not. It's heterogeneous. I think we have seen many times in our country from one hotspot. Remember those days, Sri Petaling was all in Selangor. Remember when that settled down, suddenly, boom, the bubble burst in Sabah and then gradually came back to Selangor. And now basically almost every state, maybe not Perlis or Putrajaya, but generally everywhere. So those changes are important. The more important is the positivity rate at the local area, local level. The route of transmission, how the transmission rate is in Kelantan and Terengganu and in Perak and Selangor is different, clearly. The dynamics are different. Of course, now, currently with the lockdown, generally the lockdown is the same everywhere in the country. The MCO areas may be higher, but generally, so it is more homogenous now. But that positivity rate, regional positivity rate, becomes more important when the lockdown, as we exit the lockdown, then people begin to start normal lives again, normal activities, how well people comply, how clear the guidelines come in, the local guidelines, obviously. So I think that's something that has to be a more nuanced analysis of the data. Of course, we can compare national figures, but national figures don't tell the whole story. We do have to look at regional and local data as well.
So when we look at what Selangor has been doing, is that an example of having a slightly different testing strategy where Selangor is doing more mass testing?
I think let's be clear about this. The Ministry of Health's testing strategy is the same throughout the country. That they have, in terms of who are contacts, how they define contacts, that is standardized. And certainly Selangor State, through the Selangor Task Force for COVID, it's not changing that. We are adding value to what the MOH is doing. So what we are doing is trying to get more people tested on the ground. For example, remember those days during the outbreak among the migrant workers, the workers in one top glove, all right? All the top glove employees were being screened by MOH and the company. And that was fine. We tried to add value by also screening the areas around the locations where these folks used to stay and things like that, because we believe that obviously they don't live in a bubble or in a cave. They do come out and mix with the other community people. So we did testing there, and we found a reasonable positivity rate, and that we tried to cut down transmission by doing that. I think clearly, if you read any document or guidelines, the more testing you do, the better in terms of the surveillance and the understanding of the outbreak in that area. No question. I think that one is a given. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there must be a balance. Can we screen everybody? Can we screen everybody all the time? Obviously not. But we have to decide on what level can we screen. So what we did in Selangor was using whatever limited data that we have on the ground. We have some very good digital people working with us at the state level. And they, by using AI, artificial intelligence, they could predict where the future hotspots could be. I'm pleased to say the folks that we have there are pretty good. And they got it right most of the time. Not all the time, most of the time. And by predicting that, we could actually go ahead of the curve. That means go there and start testing people first. Of course, this is volunteering. We open up free testing, get as many people who want to come and do the testing. And once it's tested, it's positive by RTK antigen, then we will inform the health department and they will do the confirmation with PCR. I think that was useful because, of course, we tell them while waiting for the PCR test, you have to quarantine yourself, et cetera, things like that. And we provide support for that. Those who are not well, if they happen to be symptomatic, we move them into the MOH site as fast as we can. But the other important thing is we are visible. We are on the ground. When we go to one location, open up this camp and spend one whole day getting banners everywhere and getting this test being done, it also creates a community ownership that something is happening. And I think that's important. That testing is still important. That's why the state is, the municipal side felt that it's important that we continue doing this. And even as we speak, this coming weekend, they will be doing testing in a few other communities in Selangor.
Dr. Chris, you know, I love it the way you describe how testing is being done on the ground, which is it's a community effort. Everybody wants to get tested. And most importantly, the emphasis on the importance of getting tested. To know what the status of the individuals are so that they can seek treatment much, much earlier, right? And one of the things that positivity rate tells us is whether or not we've sufficiently tested people on the ground. Yes. And WHO tells us that anything above 5% is basically possibly that we're not testing enough, that if it's under 5%, then it's good. But right now, even in Selangor, we're seeing more than 7%, 8%. Which gives us a little bit of a concern for the other states. Selangor, you say that the strategy in Selangor for testing is similar to those in other states, but we know that the FTTIS strategy, the find, trace, test, isolate, and support framework has been introduced in Selangor, and it has been the reason why there's a huge number of cases that have been able to be tested and found positive, which is also one of the reasons why Selangor has been aggressive at being able to find these cases. They're not waiting for the cases to come to them. They're going out into the community to find these cases, right? So it's a very positive approach. So the concern that a lot of people have right now is, what about the other states? Why aren't the other states adopting the same kind of strategy that Selangor is doing on the ground in Selangor? Are we actually seeing an underreporting of the kind of cases that we should be seeing, like the daily cases that have been reported by the Ministry of Health? Should the number actually be much larger? Because if the positivity rates in other states are so high, even reaching double digits, that means there is insufficient testing in those states. So my question to you is, should we not have the other states also adopt the same kind of strategies that Selangor is putting into place, looking for the cases rather than opportunistic type of testing that they're currently doing?
Right. Well, to be fair, I think MOH is doing some targeted testing. They are targeting testing, for example, certain work sites. I think manufacturing and the construction sector is being always targeted for testing. Whether that's equally aggressively done in all states, I don't know. I'm sure the state directors will look into it. What's the Selangor state government is doing through the SDFC and SDFO is to add value, going to the community. We have gone to the community to get people. And we think that a community testing is useful. It gives us a rough idea what is happening on the ground. The targeted testing at the workplaces and things at the schools and whatever, I think MOH is looking into it. And the government is working with various sectors through MITI and or educate MOE to do these things. And they have authority to do that, not the state level. So we focus on the community. And because we are also limited, we can't be screening, mass screening in the wider sense of the word. We have to use, let's say, our AI to help us pick and predict. Is that enough? Probably not. I guess during a pandemic, we just do what we can with the resources that we have. All the tests that we do, I'm sure you have seen our advertisement, it's all free. It's funded by the state. We use RTK antigen, obviously, which is pretty good, actually. But since MOH still asks for confirmation, the confirmation test will be done with PCR by KKM.
All right. I'm speaking today to my co-host, Azrul Mohamad Khalib, CEO of the Galen Centre for Health and Social Policy. We've got Datuk Dr. Christopher Lee, infectious diseases physician, on Zoom with us as well. It's our public health show, and we're discussing what should come next now that we are in this full MCO 3.0. How do we transition out of it? Call us if you have any questions or thoughts to share. 03-7733-2900. WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We'll be right back after these messages. BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Ik. My co-host is on Zoom with me, Azrul Mohamad Khalib, CEO for the Galen Centre for Health and Social Policy for our public health series. And our guest today is Dato' Dr. Christopher Lee, infectious diseases physician. We're discussing what next after this MCO 3.0. How long should it go on for? Or more importantly, what should we be looking ahead to consider easing into the next phase? I think the Prime Minister did mention that there would be phases to this MCO 3.0. But I think for many of us, Dr. Chris, as we are looking at daily numbers, we don't have perspective. We don't have a long-term view. We are just getting anxious as numbers go up, perhaps feeling a bit of relief as numbers go down slightly, without being able to understand the bigger picture. And that's what I hope that we can try to understand a little better today. But there was something Azrul mentioned earlier before the break, that the positivity rate is actually still high in Selangor and possibly in other states as well. Does this mean that even as we are getting anxious with numbers like 6,000 over, we have something like 6,200 new cases today, could it actually be higher? I'm just trying to see where is the end point that we should be looking at. I know you already said don't look at these numbers alone. How do we have in mind some sort of parameters, and what time frame, to achieve that in?
Right. Well, we know that we always talk about 2 weekly intervals based on the incubation period that we are familiar with, and a 14-day way of thinking it through helps a little bit. So clearly, we are in the middle of this first 2 weeks of it. Frankly, I expect the numbers gradually to come down. How much it comes down by day 14, I don't think it will come to triple digits if we continue to test the way we test. I think, however, the numbers will come down. So the question is, what is the threshold that the government is planning to use before they decide? What are the parameters we are looking for before we decide we can move to the next level of the MCO? I know I get all confused with all the alphabets, but the next level of MCO, a more relaxed MCO, whatever, less of a lockdown. Some countries use the color coding, some use alphabet, ABC, whatever, it doesn't matter. But I think that might be something good we can use now. And I think planning forward, as I said, the numbers will come down. Will they come down to a level that we're happy with in 2 weeks? Probably not. I think most people expect it to be extended in some shape or form, maybe with some relaxation in certain key areas, perhaps. But for another maybe 2 weeks, I think it's quite likely. But I think it's important that we start, the planning starts with all of us, all the various sectors, and also public, even our own individual, ourselves individually. For example, in, let's say, the main areas of economics, the manufacturing or the construction. Obviously, keeping construction or manufacturing closed for an indefinite period is painful for the economy. The question is, when we open up, how much do we open up? I think that is important that we need to plan now. And the planning cannot be done by MOH. The planning must be done by the ministry involved in that sector. They have to sit down together with the stakeholders and start talking. I hope they have done that. Maybe they have done that from earlier MCOs. But maybe it's time for us to relook at it. We have 1.5 years of experience. We know what works well. And we also, very importantly, know what doesn't work well. So that's important for us to start planning and drawing it up. So when we reopen, the next phase for this sector would be 1, 2, 3, 4. And for another sector, there'll be a 1, 2, 3, 4. And then we can actually, one thing I hope the government will do is share that SOP, the next level of SOP with everyone now. Don't wait until 3 days before and say we open. Because it's like helping us, if you want me to pass an exam, give me the syllabus way earlier so I can prepare. But if you give it to me 2 days before, I mean, I'm a lousy student anyway. I mean, I'm going to flop again, you know. But give me a chance to pass. And I think it's important to share with us now. Say, okay, when we do open up, it'll be like this. Mm. How you make the best out of it. We also want you to make money. How do you do it safely? You may have to invest in something or get extra people for this or that, whatever, but you plan now rather than do it 2, 3 days before and nobody does a good job. But I think if we start planning like this, it also adds to our experience because will we need another MCO-like thing in the future? We don't know. The variants are changing the equation completely. Look at America. They thought they were winning. And now Anthony Fauci is telling everyone, watch it, you know, don't have a party at 4th of July, maybe not, hold on for a while, things like that. Mm. So I think it's important for us to start planning now. And if the government can be comfortable, and I hope they will be, share with the public, all of us can get on board. We are not trying to create problems among ourselves, isn't it? But if we all know what to do, or expect to know what to do, then we can start preparing.
I mean, definitely it's become clear that when there's a void of information and direction, you get chaos. But on that note, then, what kind of information would help these individual authorities to know, you know, when it is time to open up their sector, how they can advise the SOP? What kind of public health data would they need to inform their decisions?
I think obviously the positivity rate is important. The number of positives over the number of tests being done. The profile of people who are still positive, I think that's important. The profile of people who are testing negative is also important. Now, of course, we don't get the data. Negative, if you look at all those who are tested negative, it also tells a certain story, isn't it? Of course, you look at all those who are positive, we also tell a certain story. For example, I know that in the past, we have said a lot of the infections, the clusters we see, besides, of course, there are still some in the workplace, there are still some in the manufacturing area, but a fair number were infected in the families, all right? And even in Sungai Buloh, when I do rounds, I see older folks, many of them are older folks who are infected. They did not go anywhere. Many of them said, but my son-in-law, but my daughter, they are the ones who bring him. So when people say, oh, it's all spreading in the family, I'm sorry. Of course. Why are you surprised?
I mean, that's where we let our guards down.
If three of us are infected, I mean, of course our family is first at risk, and it's nothing surprising. But Xiaoying, I cannot do anything in your home except advise you not to do this, or etc. But somebody brings that infection home. Somebody, whether an external person came to the house, made contact, or someone in the house went out to do something and came back with that. That is how. And that is important to look at how that person who introduced infection to the family, where and how they caught it. And that, to me, tells us where we focus on. Is it religious activities? Is it economic activities? Is it school, et cetera, et cetera? So I think that type of data helps. I know it's very micro data. The battle is fought, is won or lost, actually, on the ground. At national level, we give overarching principles and policies, but you know at the end we have to tweak it, isn't it? How life is lived in Kelantan, Terengganu is not the same as Bangsa. That's a fact. I'm not saying which is better, but I'm saying it's different, isn't it?
But Dr. Chris, you know, I'm glad that you highlighted that point, though, because a lot of people are forgetting how vulnerable you can be within the circles of family, friends, you know, because you think that you are sort of protected within your bubble or circle. But we saw, because of Ramadan and Hari Raya, the visitations, you know, resulted in hundreds of new clusters and definitely responsible for the influx in number of cases that we've seen over the past month or so. But if I may just swing our discussion to another point concerning, you know, looking at the epidemic ahead. I remember last year that you were appointed the head of a task force that was looking at those who had died as a result of COVID-19, and that you were tasked to basically examine, the circumstances, the vulnerabilities, and to basically generate reports to the government in order to look at trying to understand the mortality data. So one of the things that we've seen of late is the number of brought-in dead cases being on the rise. And we're seeing more and more young people who, some of them are below the age of 30 with no comorbidities, they have no pre-existing condition. So it seems that they too are dying as a result of COVID-19 infection. So what can you tell us about what's happening? Should we be more concerned? Is this, some people are discussing whether the new variants are responsible for this. I mean, what can you tell us about these increase in mortality amongst this age group, as well as those brought in dead?
Right, okay. Yeah, I mean, I was the chair of the National Mortality Committee, but since January, I've stepped down. After serving 1 year, it's time for other people to take it over. So getting old, so yeah. Some brighter and more energetic people.
Never, Dr. Chris, never.
Yeah. But I think what we said just now is very true and is also very worrying. But it's not unique in Malaysia. In other parts of the world, and I'm not talking about India or where the things are pretty bad, but even in America, in the UK, we are beginning to see more and more younger people catch it as well. They don't seem as immune as what we thought those days. Know that if you are below 30, your chances of getting really sick is really minimal. Well, it's not so minimal. It's still low, I must say. It's still low, but we are beginning to see more and more young people in the hospital as well. And you're right, we have seen some young people with no comorbidities dying as well. Is it the variant? It could very well be. And we know that KKM or MOH is doing genomic surveillance. And from time to time, you hear DG announcing about variants here and there. But I'm sure they are doing more than what is just reported now. Perhaps some committee is looking at the analysis and whether it's driving two things. Is it driving the outbreaks in Malaysia, driving transmission? And it's also, is it driving the deaths? It will be also interesting to see all those who have passed away, especially those who are the younger ones, the ones with no comorbidities. We hope we can also pick up the virus from them and do genomic surveillance to see whether there are variants causing these deaths or not. All right. I think many of the variants we know seem to be more transmissible. Some of them seem to escape the immune system, the body better. Some of them may be affected by the diagnostic, may affect diagnostics accuracy and things like that. But we haven't seen many variants directly increase mortality, directly, all right? Of course, when the virus, when the strain or variant is more infectious, more people catch it at the same time, the deaths will go up. That's generally the case. Similarly, what's happening in Malaysia now. But it's not directly due to the virus, the variant being more pathogenic, all right? So that's a difference. But you are right, that could very well be driving it. So at the end of the day, obviously, while we talk about releasing the lockdown or MCO and how we want to face it and stage it and prepare for it, of course, the end game is going to be the vaccines. There's no question. And I think the data around the world shows that majority of the countries who have heavily vaccinated seem to be doing well, right? Certainly not out of the woods. Even in America and UK, they still have pockets. But obviously, that's our biggest frontier as such. But I think when you brought up something, just now I want to reiterate, Azro, you mentioned FTTIS. Well, we wish all of us will get vaccinated tomorrow and, you know, 80% of Malaysians will get their shots tomorrow. But that's not going to happen that way. It's going to take time. Is it end of the year? What the government is hoping to achieve? Hopefully, I hope we get there. But from now to December or to whatever date they set, it's still months. A lot of people can die and fall sick. We still have to depend on FTTIS to be better. I think the important focus is how do we make sure we don't have another lockdown and be as safe and as prosperous as we can be until the vaccines kick in.
So that will come back to everything that you've said. FTTIS, looking at more nuanced and understanding and being able to use the nuanced data about positivity rates, more regional data, disaggregating it, and being able to understand where we can target strategies based on a better understanding of this data. But since you brought up vaccination, I think it would be good for us to just very quickly look at where we are in terms of vaccination and address some of the concerns that people still seem to have when it comes to getting the jabs. And we'll do that when we come back after another quick break. My co-host Azrul Mohamad Khalib, CEO of the Galen Center for Health and Social Policy, is on Zoom with me. And we are speaking to Dato' Dr. Christopher Lee, infectious diseases physician. It's our public health segment today, and we're discussing MCO 3.0, what next? So call us if you have any questions or thoughts, 03-7733-2900 or WhatsApp 018-789-8899. We'll be right back after this quick break, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiaoying. It's our public health series today, and my co-host, Azrul Mohamad Khalib, CEO of the Galen Center for Health and Social Policy, on Zoom with me. And we're speaking to Dr. Christopher Lee, infectious diseases physician. We're discussing how to transition out of this current full MCO 3.0 that we have entered. It's been almost a little over a week now. It's supposed to end on the 14th of June, but you know, that's exactly what we're discussing today. What do we need? Where do we need to be at in order for the government to look at whether it will be extended or eased into the next phase? And Dr. Chris, you already have brought up vaccinations, and we're looking at that ramping up vaccinations to bring us out of this up and down, in and out of MCOs that we're going through. And strategies have been announced to ramp up vaccinations, and we're seeing higher numbers of doses being delivered per day, although it's not reached a consistent level just yet. But are there any gaps when it comes to the vaccination program that you think should be highlighted and that we need to keep our eyes on?
Well, I think we were told that the last month, May was going to be a rather slow month because the amount of vaccines coming in into the country in May was we know we're not that huge, all right? I think nearly 1 million doses, perhaps, you know, something to that ballpark figure. But we are more excited because we know in June and July, the number of doses coming in will significantly increase. We hope the manufacturers will keep their schedule with the country and get, because obviously the first thing is we need to get the doses. We can get doses, we can give it. If we don't have doses, well, it's the end of the show, yeah? I must say I'm optimistic, but what the committee under YBKJ has put together, they seem to be really pushing it, preparing everything, hoping it blows up. He's talking about mega centers, and I mean, it's okay. In other countries, people have done it. Will it work well? We don't know. Put it in, try it, and if it doesn't work so well, we can tweak it as we go along. No one knows for sure, right? Mega centers work very well in certain places and may not work so well in other places. But to me, at least we are trying to drive it up. But one area I think will make a difference is, number one, involving the GPs in the vaccination program. Many of us living in urban or semi-urban areas, many of our kids are vaccinated by our private colleagues, our GPs, our friendly GPs, because it's easy. It's, you know, around the corner, everybody's there. And they have been doing it for years and years and years and years. They know it very well. And the vaccines they'll be getting now, even with Pfizer, I mean, the storage requirements are less than what it used to be already. And so I think they're really on the ball. We just have to make the arrangements with them and get them, because their network is fantastic. The KKs are already doing it, and that's fine. But the add-on to me, the game changer may be when we get the GPs into play and play them well. The other area I think which will also be very helpful will be allowing the private procurement, the private sector to procure vaccines. And this will include the private hospitals and also maybe some state governments or companies and things like that, because they can add value. As long as we add value to what PICK is doing, we are fine. As long as you don't compete for the same doses, we are fine, all right? So, for example, we know what the government is buying. They are buying, you know, Pfizer or AstraZeneca, so much, so much, so much. If the manufacturer can give us more than what the government already is buying, that's fine, as long as we're not interfering. Because you're right, if we compete, then it's not good, because the government, at the end of the day, should have the bigger say, because they should see the whole picture. We are adding value. But at the end, it's important. The faster we get ourselves vaccinated, the faster we can get out of this.
Oh, Dr. Chris, that's precisely the message that we're wanting to hear from persons like yourself, you know, because it's been a roller coaster experience for a lot of people who are wanting to get vaccinated as soon as possible. So there's been, you know, a lot of people who've been registered much earlier and they still haven't gotten their appointments yet. But we are now hearing today that 150,000 that have been receiving their dose. But also today, unfortunately, a moment ago, it was announced that we could actually be experiencing a delay in the vaccination supply from Thailand for AstraZeneca, which could actually disrupt the schedule as what was proposed. So the discussion would be, do you think that if there is a severe disruption, should Malaysia adopt a strategy where the priority would be to ensure that everyone gets at least one dose, meaning priority is to ensure that people are at least protected with one dose, as opposed to trying to get as many people as possible to delay the second dose. Yeah, so you delay the second dose. Do you think we should change the strategy?
Well, I think AstraZeneca has given us a lot of experience with that, as I'm sure you're familiar with the data. AstraZeneca, by delaying it by up to three months, the efficacy actually improved, isn't it? Right, which is fantastic. That's why those who had took on the opt-in AstraZeneca dose, I think it's been spaced 3 months apart, 12 weeks. But you're right, it is a call the government has to make. I think it's budgeting, basically. They have to be clear how much vaccine they are really getting bought and how confident they are. And they have to make the call that, is it enough to give everybody you know, those scheduled doses in 3 or 4 weeks? Or would it be better to give everyone? They have to make that call. There's no right and wrong here. Because obviously, if we have enough vaccines, I have to say, why delay? Give it, right? But we have to make that decision. It's budgeting in our own household. If I have X amount of money, I've got 4 kids. Three of them wants to go to study overseas, and my resources won't be enough. I have to make a call, you know?
That's something everyone can relate to.
I know Azro sending all her kids overseas, and you know, all very clever with scholarships, but not all of us are in that position. And we have to budget. We have to make that decision. Do we turn? And that's what my father told me a long time ago. I can only send one of you overseas to study. And I decided I'll study in Malaysia because I like Malaysian food. I didn't tell my father that, but I said, let my sister go and study overseas to play the big, nice big brother. But that was a fact. My father told me that one of you can go, but two of you, I'm sorry, I can't afford to send both of you overseas.
I mean, I think...
And that's a fair decision they have to make, but they need to be frank. They need to be frank and be able to admit to themselves. If we can't get it, doesn't mean it's a failure, because every country is stretching. We are not the top of the pecking order in terms of vaccine. Let's be frank. It's a call that only they can make.
Absolutely. And be frank, the transparency of whatever deliberations are taking place is something that provides a lot of reassurance for everyone as well at this point. As we are looking not only at daily case numbers, we're also looking at vaccine doses being delivered and wondering when it's our turn, when are our parents' turn. But, you know, apart from this big picture of supplies and doses and how they can be delivered and brought into arms, there's also at the micro level still vaccine hesitancy among people. And, you know, just one of the things that's come out where YBKJ has said that people are rejecting certain vaccines at some of the PPVs, and this is sort of, you know, disrupting the flow of the vaccination program. Now, this could be the case for some people who are even listening to this show right now, that they think one vaccine is better than the other. What would you say to them, Dr. Chris?
The best vaccine, I know it sounds like cliche, the best vaccine is what is in front of you now. Take it.
Where is this coming from? Where is this hesitation or this bias for one over the other? Where is it coming from?
Well, I think, for example, AstraZeneca, the reason why I can understand why they put in the AstraZeneca opt-in program, the one recently, is because they were fearful, and I think I understand their predicament, thinking that many people would refuse the AZ. And therefore, if they put it into the PICK, PIC, many people will withdraw. I'm not sure whether it's accurate, but apparently there will be some people withdrawing from registering for MySejahtera after they realize AstraZeneca has come into the country, all right? And I can understand that. And they experimented with the opt-in, which seemed to have run very well, which is great. And I think that's fine. To me, that's what excites me. No one knows what will work in this country. But as long as somebody is thinking, trying something, monitoring it, and tweak it as we go along, to me, that's okay. Because no one knows for sure, all right? But that program worked out well. Remember, a couple of hours, everything was gone. And then another large chunk came out later and everything was gone. And now they're putting AstraZeneca back into the PICK, the national rollout. But generally, I think it's important. If you look at numbers, of course, the Pfizer and Moderna, data looks very good, 94-95% effectiveness, efficacy. And of course, you said AstraZeneca or Sinovac, the numbers don't seem to be so good. But remember, none of these vaccines were compared head to head. They were all compared with nothing. All right. So the important data is this: all of them, all those that registered with WHO, FDA, and also NPRA showed the number of deaths and hospitalization significantly reduced, almost close to zero, 100% effectiveness against admission or serious illness or death. To me, that's the main thing. That's the main thing. It's like influenza, isn't it, right? Influenza, we are not worried because when we catch it, majority of us will be fairly mild, except those who are elderly or those with comorbidities. Then, of course, influenza can also run havoc. So the main thing is not getting admitted to hospital and, of course, not dying.
So
I think take the vaccine that's available because... That's the best one because if you don't have a choice, of course, if the government can buy all the vaccines they want in the world and you have a choice, you can pick what is most appropriate. For example,
so this is how we respond to aunties and uncles who say the reason why they don't want to take AstraZeneca, they went for the Sinovac one because they want to go to China after this, and feel that if they can't get a Chinese-made vaccine, they won't be allowed entry into the country. So
I mean, I will say that you can take Sinovac out of that equation and then replace Pfizer in there and still have a similar argument as well.
Exactly.
I was thinking of Sinovac because I also wanted to read the Chinese newspapers like YBKJ, but there you go. But since I got Pfizer, I'm okay with it. But jokes aside, if you have all the vaccines in the world available and you can really truly pick without disturbing the program overall, then for a good example, if you're a 20-year-old girl or 30-year-old girl, would you take AstraZeneca versus Pfizer? If it's my daughter, I would say, okay, maybe take Pfizer or Sinovac versus AstraZeneca because we know that the thrombocytopenic clots is still very small, it's slightly higher in that group for young women, especially. I don't know why women. Until today, we don't understand that. But overall, the benefits of the vaccine for AstraZeneca still outweighs the risk by far. By far. So to me, the risk is very low, all right? So I'm concerned about the part that in the future we are allowed to select our vaccines, isn't it, right? When that happens, I hope the government can only do that if they really have good access to a lot of vaccines, then people can pick. Otherwise, it may make the rollout a bit harder.
Okay, Azrul, one last quick question from you.
Well, just Dr. Chris, if you look at where we are today and where do you want to go, we want to avoid a roller coaster of or sekejap ada, sekejap tak ada, 1 minute MCO, no MCO. What is one firm recommendation that you can make to the government in terms of how it should change or continue on with its strategy? What is the one thing that you want to see change?
I think we have to strengthen our digital platform. I know we have MySejahtera, and I think it has taken us to a fair level. We can argue how far it's gone. The question is it the platform that is what we need to have? I think that's important, all right? What we have now, is it good enough? And I think that's important to make that decision. And I hope it's not just because it is, that's pride, that's our platform, then it's the best that we have got. What's ours may not be the best. And I think we need to be frank how to make it better. I'm not wrecking MySejahtera, but get the best digital platform that we need. We need to decide what we have. It's like buying a car. If you want to reach a destination looking very grand, maybe you buy a BMW or a Merc, but you just want to get there in four wheels without as cheaply as possible, a Myvi and Proton is basically fantastic, isn't it? So we just have to decide what's your priority. But to me, besides getting a digital platform, it will make a lot of the FTTIS easier. By applying a digital platform, we can use artificial intelligence to help us predict future hotspots, can monitor, like for example, HIDE, HIDE is also some form of that kind of platform. We can predict, go in before actual clusters begin. But the important thing, despite digital platform, is strengthen testing and contact tracing.
And that's where a digital platform would enhance as well.
May help, yes. Mm. But we also do need boots on the ground. Yes. At the end, you might still need more people to do that. Boris Johnson, besides his hairstyle, he amazed me by saying he had 100,000 contact tracers in the country. scattered around the country to help with contact tracing. Now, contact tracing is easier because all of us are locked up in our houses. Mm. Finding Azro, you know, easy to find Azro now, you know, where else can we go? But once the lockdown is being phased out, all of us may be moving a lot more. Our digital, our COVID footprint every day will be wider, isn't it? So contact tracers need to be really on the ball. And I think this is time we need to build up that capacity so that when the MCO is lifted, we know there will be more cases. There may be more clusters. That is a given, and it's not insulting anyone. That is a fact. We must be prepared for that. We must be better than what we were before so that our contact tracers, our digital platform, doesn't get overwhelmed. So the clusters should be small and should be closed easily. Every time, I want to say this, every time we have a large cluster, we miss the boat. Mm. Think about it. The fact that we have a large cluster, that means the system failed. We missed the boat. I'm not criticizing people. It's tough on the ground. But we must make that system better. It is our job.
And like
it is our job. And that part only we can do. Only we can, you know, I mean, healthcare professionals or public health people especially, like only we can do.
Like you said, than the staying ahead. Yeah, staying ahead of the curve to be able to do all that testing so that you can get it before it flares up. I'm afraid we've run out of time, though. We've been speaking to Azro Mohammad Khalib, CEO of the Galen Centre for Health and Social Policy, and Dato Dr. Christopher Lee, infectious diseases physician. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.